Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Jonathan Speier makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute, and thanks to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, who brought Dr. Speier to Australia and made him available to us this evening. He's Executive Director of the Middle East Centre for Reporting and Analysis. He's also a Research Fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies and a Fellow at the Middle East Forum. Dr. Speier is a freelance security analyst for James Intelligence Review and writes the Behind the Lines column in the Jerusalem Post. Now, he's also most recently the author of Days of the Fall, A Reporter's Journey in the Syria and Iraq Wars, which was published earlier this year. Routledge is the publisher. It's available on Amazon. And tonight, Jonathan Speier is going to talk for us on the topic of Syria 2.0, the current situation in Syria, and how it affects the region. Jonathan Speier, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, and good evening to everybody. And what I intend to do is to speak at you, as I was asked to do, for about half an hour, after which we will have a discussion, which no doubt will be the more interesting part of the evening's proceedings. In the half hour available to me to speak at you, what I'm going to try and do is not give a potted history of the war in Syria, but certainly to note what seemed to me at least to have been the key watershed moments in the war. And then I'm going to go on to look at what in my estimation are a number of new characterised by mass demonstrations into an armed insurgency by the end of 2011, turning into 2012. Now, interestingly, in the summer, in June, July of 2012, the Assad regime carries out a strategic withdrawal from a large swathe of the northern part of Syria. And in so doing, the regime sort of laid bare one of the central dynamics of the conflict, which has continued to characterise it until today, namely the shortage available to the Assad regime of loyal manpower. The Assad regime was short of men willing to take a bullet for it. And the reason for that was because of the narrow sectarian base of the regime. Obviously, the Assads themselves coming from the Alawi community in Syria. The Alawis are only around 12% of the country. So a narrow base of available manpower. Assad looked at the map and said, okay, well, a logical response to this, given I haven't got enough people, would be to withdraw from lands that I don't absolutely need to defend in order to better defend those that I must hold on to. What Assad felt he had to hold on to was the western coastal areas of Syria and the capital of Damascus, and insofar as he could, the line of cities going northwards from Damascus, Homs, Hama, and Aleppo, on the close to the Syrian-Turkish border. In so doing, Assad effectively ushered in the de facto partition of Syria that to a considerable extent continues to pertain until this day. He, having left the areas in question, control was rapidly taken there by Sunni Arab rebels in the Arab areas, and by the Syrian franchise of the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, in the Kurdish majority areas in the northeast. And the northeast of Syria then further subdivided in 2013 with the entry into Syrian soil of the former Al-Qaeda branch in Iraq, now renamed Islamic State in Iraq, which, having entered Syria, then further renamed itself Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, drove out other forces and created an area of control of itself, dividing Syria into the four areas of control that we still see today. Of course, the size of the areas of control have changed radically since 2012, 2013, but the entities themselves remain very much in existence. Parallel to the strategic dilemma faced by the regime, namely the shortage of readily available manpower, the rebellion faced a similar dilemma. In the rebellion's case, the absence was not that of manpower, the absence was that of organisation and unity. And in my estimation, the story of the Syrian war from 2012 until this day is effectively the story of how the regime managed to address adequately the strategic dilemma facing it, namely the absence of manpower, while the rebellion fails to address adequately its own dilemma, namely that of poor organisation and disunity. We can trace another couple of watershed moments where the regime's shortage of people comes close to destroying it and then doesn't do so because of the intervention of the powerful friends available to the regime. In 2013, the regime comes once more close to eclipse at the hands of the rebellion, and then Islamic Republic of Iran, the close ally of the Assad regime since the 1980s, since the Islamic Revolution in Iran of 1979, steps in using its own well-known paramilitary methods of mobilization of proxies from across the region, proxy fighters from Lebanon, from Iraq, but also from as far afield as Afghanistan and Pakistan, are mustered and brought onto Syrian soil to fill the gap in manpower faced by the regime, firstly. And secondly, Iran comes in and begins to organize and recruit additional local paramilitary forces based on young men, young Syrian men, for the most part, members of minority communities, organized into new paramilitary structures created by the Iranians to fill the gap facing the regime. That's 2013. But 2 years on, in 2015, once again the regime faces the prospect of defeat, and that's because at that time in 2015 the rebellion comes closest, as close as it would ever come, I think we can now say with some confidence, to achieving a unified force. A force called Jaish al-Fatah, Army of Conquest, is created in northern Syria in 2015. It represents the coming together of militia groups supported by the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Turks. And for the first time, they're working together, and they're pushing westwards towards Latakia province and the Syrian western coast, which is protected by mountains, the Alawi Mountains, they're called. And there's a couple of valleys through them. And the rebels came close to pushing through the valley, and had they done so and reached the western coast of Syria, it would probably have been game over for the regime. The regime would have lost its heartland of Latakia province. That didn't happen, of course. And it didn't happen not because of the military abilities of the Assad regime, certainly, and not because, in this case, of the continued assistance afforded to the regime by the Iranians. Rather, it did not happen because of the appearance on September 30th, 2015, for the first time, of Russian aircraft over the skies of Syria. And once the Russian Air Force had appeared over the skies of Syria, at that point, there was no way in which the rebellion could achieve victory short of the intervention of an air force equal in ability to that of the Russians. Now, such air forces do, of course, exist in the world, but the political conditions by 2015, whereby they would have wished to intervene on behalf of what was by then a largely Sunni Islamist rebellion, did not exist. No such air force appeared. And consequently, the subsequent history of the Syrian war from autumn 2015 until today has been that of the slow grinding back of the rebellion from the areas it controlled, most notably, of course, from Aleppo City at the end of 2016, but then also from Homs and from Hama and from the Damascus countryside and so on and so forth. The gradual pushing back of the rebellion is what took place subsequently. Now, parallel to that war, of course, from 2014 onwards, there was another conflict system operating in eastern Syria, a war which was birthed, so to speak, by the original war of regime against rebels, and that was the war of global coalition against Islamic State. Islamic State, having come onto Syrian soil, then reinvaded back into Iraq in the very dramatic events of summer 2014, and in so doing, triggering a US-led global coalition against it, which then sets about seeking to destroy the Islamic State. And in a relatively similar process from a military point of view, the global coalition, once again, like the Assad regime, enjoying complete air superiority, begins slowly and inexorably to grind back the Islamic State, until what remains today in both conflict systems is a few outlying areas held by, in the regime rebel case, the rebels, in the coalition ISIS case, Islamic State, facing possible eclipse in the near future at the hands of the winning side. Thus far then, in terms of how we got to where we currently are today, we have the regime rebel war, not yet completed, but with the rebels clearly with no further chance of victory, holding on in a number of outlying areas, and we have Islamic State, also, of course, with no chance of victory, holding on in just a couple of areas in Middle Euphrates River Valley, and then just west of the Euphrates. What's coming next, then, if these conflict systems are indeed winding down, as we think they as they appear to be? What is not coming next, in my estimation, as I've already hinted, is a return to goodwill and good governance. It's not a return, the emergence of goodwill and good governance in Syria. Indeed, what's not even returning is a return to the status quo ante bellum of, so to speak, March 14th, 2011, the day before the school children's demonstrations began in Daraa, that kicked the whole process off. That's not coming back either. What does rather seem to be coming into being are a whole series of new conflicts, as I said at the beginning, consisting of contests between the various players who have come onto Syrian soil in the course of the war of the last 7 years. Now, this is a fascinating process to observe. Before I go on to look at the conflicts in detail, let's say a few things about them that they have in common. The first and most notable aspect that these new conflicts have in common is that none of them are primarily driven by internal Syrian dynamics. Right? Unlike the regime rebel war, or arguably the emergence of the Islamic State, none of this has anything much to do with the desire of the Syrian people themselves. The Syrian people themselves are no longer driving this bus, so to speak. They are, to a great extent, working on behalf of various external factors and actors, if I can put it that way. Yeah? And the second fascinating thing to observe about the emergent new conflicts on Syrian soil, and this is fascinating in particular for veteran students of the Middle East and the Arab world, of which I spy perhaps a few in the audience, and of which I'm certainly one myself. And this aspect is the following. If we look at the protagonists of all the new conflicts I'm about to try to outline and explain on Syrian soil, we discover not only that none of them are Syrian, but also that none of them are Arab. None of them are Arabic-speaking, at least not Arabic as a first language. Now, this is Syria we're talking about, of course. This is the Syria that is referred to in Arab nationalist ideology and in Arab nationalist circles still as the beating heart of Arabism, or, if you want to quote the illustrious British MP George Galloway, a great admirer of the Assad regime, the last castle of the Arabs. This is Galloway's typically florid rhetoric. That's to say, Syria has played a special part, a very special role in the politics of post-colonial Arab world. You know, it was a centre of Arab nationalist ideology, of secular Arabism, and indeed of secular Arabist political and military organisation. And here is this Syria today, thoroughly penetrated by a variety of non-Arab forces who today are competing among themselves, so to speak, on the fragmented soil of Syria. And these forces speak a variety of languages. They speak Turkish, and some of them Kurdish, and some of them Russian, and some of them Farsi, some of them English, and some of them Hebrew. But none of them speak Arabic, at least not as a first language. This is a fascinating process in and as of itself. So let us then turn to look at these new conflicts. Who is fighting who, and where are they engaging with one another? I think three or four new conflicts that we need to touch upon. The first one, if I start from north to south, so to speak, in terms of the map of Syria, the first emergent conflict on the soil of Syria is a conflict that has existed for a long time, but it wasn't being played out on Syrian soil, and that is the conflict between Turks and Kurds, or more specifically, between the government of the Republic of Turkey and the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK insurgency, which has been engaged in battle against Turkey since 1984. So for a long and a bloody insurgency that has now emerged onto Syrian soil. How did that happen? Well, it happened because the Kurdish party that took control of the areas that Bashar Assad vacated in July of 2012 in the northeast of the country was a party called Democratic Union Party, or PYD, PYD. And this party is the Syrian franchise, so to speak, of the PKK, or of the Öcalan movement among the Kurds. Which means that from a Turkish point of view, what has happened is that a mortal enemy of Turkey has now taken control of a very large swathe of the very long, 900 kilometer long, Syrian-Turkish border. And Turkey is determined to try to turn back that reality. A word about the Kurdish forces who've taken control of that area. People will be here will be aware, I think, that you know, to say that this is a franchise of the PKK is today at least a controversial statement, because many of the defenders of the Kurds in Syria would like to say, well, no, this is not the PKK. You know, this is not the connected to a designated terrorist organisation. It's a quite different thing. I think that's not really accurate. And I say that not because I'm in any way an opponent of the Syrian Kurds, but purely for the sake of analytical accuracy. The PYD is connected to the Öcalan movement. And therefore, Turkish anger with regard to its emergence is not surprising. That's not to justify subsequent Turkish actions, but just to be accurate in terms of the analysis. In any case, what's therefore taking place in northern Syria today is an effort by Turkey to undermine and eventually, if it can, destroy the de facto Kurdish sovereignty that exists east of the Euphrates River. The Turks, however, have a problem, because in addition to being, I think, you know, demonstrably the Syrian franchise of the PKK, the Syrian Kurdish forces are also the most reliable and most effective military forces, whose discovery by the United States has led to one of the few but very notable successes that the Americans have had in proxy warfare in the Middle East in recent decades. It's a partnership that works. The partnership between the Kurdish YPG, the YPG, and United States air power is what has led to, more than any other single factor, the destruction of the Islamic State, of ISIS, on the soil of Syria. And that relationship is one that the Americans, for various reasons, appear currently at least to want to preserve, which means that a second contest, fascinatingly emerging on Syrian soil as a result of these events, is a contest, not a conflict, but a contest of wills between the Republic of Turkey on the one hand and the United States of America on the other, regarding the future arrangements of the Kurdish-dominated part of eastern or northeastern Syria. A third, no less fascinating, emergent conflict taking place in Syria today is a conflict between the Assad regime / Iran on the one hand and the United States and their allies on the other. It has been stated by both President Bashar Assad of Syria and his foreign minister Walid Mualem in the course of the last month that they are determined to liberate, as they call it, the entirety of their country, including the area currently dominated by the Kurds and the Americans. That's to say 30%, if you remember, of the territory of the country in the eastern part of that country. They can't do that by military force, because, of course, they're not able to fight, as indeed is nobody else on the planet is able to directly challenge the United States armed forces on the conventional battlefield. An attempt was made in February of this year by a column of fighters from pro-regime militia and Russian military contractors associated with the private military company Wagner, the delightfully named private military company Wagner from Russia. And this column crossed the Euphrates River on February 9th, when we check the date, in order to try to grab a gas field, the Conoco gas field in southern Deir ez-Zor province from the Kurds / the Americans. The Americans tried to use the deconfliction channel they have with the Russians to say these people should stop and turn back and go back across to the western side of the Euphrates. But the Russians said, well, these are not our regular forces. These are irregulars and pro-regime tribesmen. So we've nothing to do with us. So the force kept them coming eastwards until the Americans activated air power and marine artillery located in eastern Syria, and the force was then obliterated, and much fewer than 500 men then made their way back across the Euphrates, proving what ought to have been obvious, which is that you can't take the Americans on in the conventional battlefield in 2018. Nobody can do it. That doesn't mean you don't have any options against the Americans if you want to oppose them. And what the Iranians and Assad do know how to do very well is proxy warfare and insurgency. And that is what they are currently trying to ignite in the American / Kurdish-controlled part of eastern Syria. So a third conflict emergent in eastern Syria, taking the form of the political and irregular warfare that the Iranians and the Assads do rather well, is currently coming into being. And a fourth and final new conflict taking place on the soil of Syria is the conflict between Israel and Iran. Last but not least, so to speak. Iran, as I mentioned before, has been absolutely vital in the survival of the Assad regime. And Iran's contribution, unlike the Russian contribution, has largely taken the form of contribution of ground fighters, of proxy ground forces. Those forces are there on Syrian soil, and they're not going anywhere anytime soon. One of the characteristics of Iranian assistance to friends of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that it can be nice to get the Iranians in at a moment of need, but when the moment of need has passed, it's extremely difficult to get them out again. That's something which the Iraqis are discovering also, having been happy to accept the assistance of the Iranians in raising up a 150,000-strong Shia militia force to face ISIS back in the summer of 2014, and now finding that's settled into being a permanent presence in Iraq. And it's what the Syrians and others are going to discover on Syrian soil too. The Iranians are in there and they aren't going anywhere. From an Israeli point of view, that's worrying, because Israel knows that this infrastructure is there and it's not going anywhere. It's been rather busy, of course, fighting the rebellion over the course of the last 5 years, which is the reason why it entered Syria in the first place. But the war against the rebellion, as we've noted, is winding down, which means that this infrastructure can now be turned to other tasks. Iran seeks the eradication of Israel as a strategic goal. Just 2 weeks ago, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei tweeted out a message describing Israel as a cancerous tumour in Western Asia which needed to be uprooted. So, consequently, the Israelis are worried about this presence, and Israel has set a goal the goal that has been set is the desire for Iran to leave Syria in its entirety. That may well be beyond immediate achievement, but certainly Israel is determined to degrade, so to speak, the Iranian infrastructure, both human and material, in Syria at the present time, and to prevent its entrenchment and consolidation. Those are the words that the government of Israel uses in its press statements in this regard. What that's meant in practice has been a series of air raids, of air action undertaken by Israel on Syrian soil over recent months, since February, when the first clearly attributed action was taken, in order to prevent the Iranians from bringing in certain weapon systems, air defence systems and UAVs into Syria. And if it was the case, as I think it may well have been, that the bombing raid conducted yesterday, which people may have read about in your news feeds, near the Alb al-Kamal area, in which 52 members of a pro-Iranian militia called Kataib Hezbollah, an Iraqi militia, pro-Iranian Iraqi militia called Kataib Hezbollah, were killed. If it is the case that that was an action carried out by Israel, which it may well have been, then that represents an upping of the ante, so to speak, by Israel to take in attacks not only on physical infrastructure, not only on UAVs and air defence systems, but also an attempt to degrade the pro-Iranian arrangement of fighters, of proxy fighters, on Syrian soil, even as far east as Alb al-Kamal. Alb al-Kamal is nowhere close to the Golan Heights. Alb al-Kamal is nowhere close to Dara Suwaida and Quneitra provinces down there in the southwest. Alb al-Kamal is on the Syrian-Iraqi border all the way to the east. And the American coalition have flatly denied the initial accusation that it was they who were responsible for that action. And if it wasn't the Americans, it can only really have been Israel. So it's an interesting uptick in the situation. So a number of new conflicts then emerging on Syrian soil. Remember, we noted the Turks and Kurds. Turks versus Americans in terms of a contest of wills. Regime / Iran against the Americans in terms of eastern Syria, and Israel against Iran in terms of the Israeli determination to prevent Iranian entrenchment and consolidation on the soil of Syria. Where may all this be heading? Well, I think that in order to understand what's happening, one needs to slightly broaden the lens, so to speak, and to see these emergent new lines of conflict as perhaps part of a larger strategic contest which is underway in the region, in which we are seeing an alliance led by Islamic Republic of Iran facing off against a much looser coalition of states broadly associated with the United States of America, in which we would include in the Iranian-led alliance, of course, Iran itself, the Shia militias in Iraq, the Assad regime in Syria, Hezbollah in Lebanon, all of whom are engaged in Syria on behalf of Assad. Yeah? And on the other side, we would include, well, the United States of America, Israel, and then a number of Gulf Arab countries, UAE and Bahrain and Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and probably Sisi's Egypt as well. Many of those forces, of course, are not engaged on Syrian soil, but a number of them are. The Americans are there Israel is there. Trump would very much like, of course, to get the Gulfies in there as well, because Trump is keen, as you know, as we all know, on getting people to pay their way. So Trump doesn't see why the American taxpayer should pay for the reconstruction of eastern Syria. He wants the Saudis and maybe also the Egyptians too to help pay for it, or at least to help pay for it and to help to man it. So we see here, to understand what's happening in Syria and what will continue to happen, we need to take a slightly broader view from a strategic point of view and understand broader strategic blocks beginning to face off against one another in Syria. However, I don't want to conclude my talk on that note. I would rather bring us back, at least for a sentence or two, or a moment or two, to what I began with, namely the enormous human cost which all this has meant for the people of Syria. In what remains, and this is as somebody who has spent a great deal of time over the last 5 years reporting in the country, you know, what remains a remarkably beautiful and interesting and intricate and fragile society, you know, with all the bloodshed and cruelty that no doubt characterises its politics and its enmities, nevertheless a fascinating human society that has received an enormous act of violence against it in the course of the last 7 years of a truly tragic dimension. I think one should better finish on that note. And on that note, therefore, I'll finish, and I'll be very happy to take your questions and indeed comments. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Dr. Speier for an all-encompassing address this evening on a very important topic. As I said when I introduced our speaker, his most recent book, Days of the Fall, A Reporter's Journey in the Syria and Iraq Wars, and that's Routledge and available on Amazon. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got quite a bit of time. So you've reported in Syria, you've reported in Iraq. I mean, how scary is that?
Well, I guess scariness is a subjective issue, of course. The fact is that to do conflict journalism, you can't really allow yourself to be scared in real time, because you know it takes a lot of time and energy to be scared, and you need the time and energy to do other stuff, namely the reason why you went into Syria in the first place. So in the moment, one, I think I can speak for myself and colleagues who carried out similar work, in the moment you don't have the luxury of being afraid or so. The thoughts about what one has seen or experienced tend to come later on when you're back home again, and then you have time to think about things, and one should, I think, reflect on things. This shouldn't be an automaton-like process. One is morally required also to think deeply about the things that you take part of, not take part in, the things that you witness and see. So that's the answer. I think, you know, if you're going to do that stuff, you have to be able to cope with with the risks inherent in it, and that's, I think, what we all do our best to do.
Just stay where you are.
Okay.
Yeah. And Ida. Yeah.
Thank you very much for such an interesting analysis. Mm-hmm. Why is Iran so fiercely hell-bent on destroying Israel when it involves losing so many assets, as you've managed to tell us about Hezbollah and other military assets?
Well, the thing is this. You know, were Iran to try to launch a conventional attempt to invade and destroy Israel, it would, of course, lose. It would be defeated, and an enormous number of people and would be killed, and a great amount of assets of the Iranians would be destroyed. But the Iranians are a little bit smarter than that. I mean, the stated goal to destroy Israel is a serious one, I think, but the strategy employed to carry it out is one which is intended to be carried out at minimum cost to Iran and to Iranians. A cynic might well say that the Iranians are willing to fight Israel to the last Arab. That's to say, the Iranians much prefer to use Arab proxies in the actual physical fight against Israel rather than Iranians themselves placing themselves at risk. Hezbollah, after all, is a force crewed by Lebanese Shia Arabs, not by Iranian personnel themselves. So the first point to note is that the Iranian method of fighting Israel consists of fighting Israel largely through proxies. It's Israel rather than Iran which chooses, or has recently chosen for the first time in a new development actually, to respond directly against Iranian facilities and Iranian personnel. For most of the conflicts of the last decade or two, Israel has sort of accepted the rule that, you know, Iran fights Israel through Arabs, and then Israel fights against the designated Arabs rather than going back to Iran itself. That's now changed. Since February, Israel has begun to strike directly at Iranian infrastructure. But Iran prefers to fight through proxies. This is firstly. Secondly, the Iranian strategy as outlined for the destruction of Israel is one which is not supposed to ever involve or necessarily a sort of conventional assault on Israel by anybody. Rather, if one reads the websites of the Revolutionary Guards Corps and others, you can learn the theory. The theory is that Israel is an immensely weak and artificial state, cobbled together by the imperialists just before they left the region, without any internal sort of dynamic of its own. And therefore what needs to be done is that this little artificial entity needs to be subjected to a never-ending siege conducted on all levels, through terrorism, through economic warfare, through political warfare, until eventually it will sort of shrivel and collapse of its own contradictions. The good thing about a strategy like that, from the point of view of somebody purveying it, is that it's open-ended. You can more or less say that you're doing that or trying to do that forever, and even if the state in question never collapses, you can say, yes, but it will quite soon if we just keep on going. So it's kind of good stuff. It's good for propaganda, and at the same time, you never actually have to stand the test of someone and say, well, come on, is this actually working or not? My sense, therefore, is that whilst I have no doubt that the Iranian regime is sincere in its desire to destroy Israel, there is also an instrumental aspect to all this. And the instrumental aspect to all this is that the Iranian regime suffers from a legitimacy deficit with regard to the Arab world. The Iranians are not Arabs, and they are not Sunni Muslims, and they want to emerge as a dominant power within an area largely populated by Arabic-speaking Sunni Muslims. And the Iranians, I think that if they can sort of grab the banner of the Palestinian cause, a cause supposedly so dear to the hearts of the great masses of the Sunni Arab world, this will help them to make up for that legitimacy deficit. My own view is that it won't work. It's a flawed theory for two reasons. One is that I think Sunni Arabs in 2018 care a lot less about the Palestinian cause than perhaps the Iranians in Tehran think that they do. And the second reason is because even the extent that they do care very much about the Palestinian cause, the inbuilt distrust on the part of Sunni Arabs for Persian Shia is not likely to be trumped even by Persian Shia engaging on behalf of the Palestinians. It might work for a very short time, in a very short moment, but once the immediate engagement is finished, it will rapidly fade away again. So that's what I'd like to say with regard to their strategy and the means they wish to bring it about.
Thank you.
Hi.
You touched on all the other players in the Syrian theatre, but you didn't actually mention the long-term strategy of Russia, or what they see that they would like to take out of their aid to Assad.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for that, for the opportunity to fill in that gap, and you're quite right. Look, what is Russia looking for in Syria? I think it's quite clear. I think there are a number of factors. First of all, what's Russia not looking for? What did Russia not come into Syria in order to become? This is, first of all, important to get clear. When the Russians came in September 2015, there was great rejoicing among Iran and its various allies, because in the Arab areas, because what they thought was that they now had acquired a brand new strategic ally, and a very strong one at that, in Vladimir Putin's Russia. There was an editorial that encapsulated this sentiment, misplaced sentiment, as it turned out, by a guy called Ibrahim Al-Amin, who people may have heard of, the editor of a newspaper called Al-Akhbar, published in Lebanon, a pro-Hezbollah and pro-Assad newspaper. And Ibrahim Al-Amin was very excited about the Russian entry into Syria, and he declared the existence of a new strategic bloc in the region, which he called the 4+1 bloc. In homage, so to speak, to the P5+1 that people are familiar with. Yeah, the 4+1 alliance. What was the 4+1 alliance? Iran, Iraq, Assad, Hezbollah, that's the four, and what's the plus one? Russia. This turned out, as it turned out, was rather optimistic on the behalf of Ibrahim Al-Amin. As it turned out, Vladimir Putin had not, in fact, converted to Shia Islam, and Russia had, in fact, come into Syria for quite different purposes, which may, to a considerable extent, have sort of overlapped with Iranian purposes at a particular moment, but which, as it is now becoming clear, were by no means the same as the Iranian strategy. So what was Putin then all about in terms of committing his air force to the defence of Assad? A number of elements to note. Firstly, of course, the Russians have tangible, physical, strategic assets in Syria. Right? They have the two. If you remember, they have the two naval bases at Tartus and Latakia, and the air base in Khmeimim. Admittedly, these naval bases are rather small, but they are, or Tartus rather is small. Latakia is new, but it's significant all the same for a number of reasons. Firstly, it's the only naval base that the Russians have outside of the soil of the former Soviet Union. Secondly, it's in the Mediterranean, so it affords the Black Sea Fleet the ability to dock when it's in the Mediterranean. So not without importance. This is firstly. Secondly, one should remember that the Assad regime and the Ba'athi regimes in Syria are allies of long standing of Russia and of the Soviet Union. They're the only long standing and consistent ally which the Russians have in the Middle East area, an alliance going back all the way back to the mid-1960s. The last decade has been characterized by a sense in the Middle East that the hegemon of the region for the last two decades, the United States of America, does not stick by its allies and therefore is not a reliable ally. People look very closely at the fact that Bin Ali in Tunisia and perhaps more centrally importantly Mubarak in Egypt got into trouble back in 2010-2011 and were rapidly consigned to the trash can by their supposed American patrons after 30 or so years of faithful service because of some incomprehensible commitment to some notion of the global applicability of democracy. Right? That being a core part of the American ethos, as we are all aware, but from the point of view of sort of Middle East power brokers in the Arab world, that looked very odd and incomprehensible. They couldn't get it. Mubarak was your friend, but you threw him in the trash. What Putin, I think, was keen to make was the counter-thesis with regard to Russia, namely that if you're Russia's friend, you will see that if you get into trouble, Russia will do absolutely everything possible to keep you in your seat. And that is precisely what Putin has done successfully with regard to Assad, using some pretty brutal and ruthless methods, to be sure, but nevertheless achieving the desired objective. Two more elements, I think, with regard to Russia's aims. I think, thirdly, Putin had been investing heavily in the Russian army, of course, the new and revamped Russian army, over the decade and a half prior to the Syrian war. I think Putin wanted to see if his army worked, not only for the benefit of everybody else, but for his own benefit too. He's been rotating commanders and fighters through Syria in three-month tours of duty. As many of us here are aware, the only real way to tell if soldiers know what they're doing is to look at them trying to do it when other soldiers are shooting at them and trying to kill them. And that's what has just happened with regard to Russian personnel who have been through Syria. Putin's looked at them, the rest of them looked at them too, and it seems his new army works fairly well. And lastly, with regard to weapons systems, you know, it's a good thing to show, if you can show your army works, that's good for orders of weapons systems too. And we can see, even till today, since the intervention in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Turkey, there are all orders in for Russian air defence systems, so it's good for business too. So there you go. Those four aspects, I think, are the crucial reasons for Assad's intervention. Now, this is important. What's the fallout from this? What's now becoming clear, both to friends of Assad regime and to non-friends, is that Russia was not about simply following the Iranian lead with regard to Assad. And so also not following Assad's lead with regard to what he thinks should be in Syria. So if we look at the Russian actions with regard to Turkey and Turkey's interventions into Syria in early 2017, we see this discrepancy. Assad and the Iranians were furious about the Turkish intervention into Syria in August 2016 and then again in January 2017. It's an invasion of sovereign Syrian soil. But the Turks wouldn't have dared to put a boot across the border without Russian permission. And the Russians were happy to allow them to do it. Because Russia's in a position where it wants to be an arbiter and give a little bit of what everybody wants to everybody and then arbitrate between them. That's not at all what the Iranians and Assad want, but it's what Russia wants. Similarly, with regard to Israeli air action over Syrian soil, couldn't take place, or at least certainly couldn't take place with the smoothness that it has taken place if Russian air defence systems were brought into play. And Russian air defence systems are there on the ground in Latakia province. But when the Israelis go in, the Russians turn a blind eye. Why is that? Same reason. Russia isn't looking for trouble with Israel. Russia likes or dislikes Israel on the same level that it likes or dislikes Iran or any other foreign country, depending on Russian interests. Yeah? And that's the way in which Russia will proceed, and very few others can stand in their way to stop them.
Thank you very much, Dr. Speyer, for your insightful analysis. I have a question. Is there any slight possibility of an accommodation between Israel and the Assad regime?
Yeah, I think that there is. a possibility of such an accommodation. I think much will depend on the ability of the Assad regime and Russia to prevent the deployment of the Iranians and their associated militias close to the border with Israel, close to the border with the Golan Heights, the Qunetra crossing. From an Israeli point of view, and this is based on conversations with people also in the Israeli professional echelon dealing with this stuff, you know, there isn't a moral judgment, so to speak, with regard to the Assad regime. Of course, Israel doesn't like the Assad regime and is aware of the crimes that it's committed, but Israel is not engaged in, you know, trying to fix to heal the world, so to speak, as an aspect of foreign policy. Rather, it's seeking to defend Israeli interests. In that regard, if the rebellion has been defeated or is on the verge of defeat, and Assad's coming back to the border, Assad's forces are coming back to the border, that's a reality with which Israeli commanders can live, just as much as Jordanian commanders would live with it and whoever else has to live next to them on the border. Assad's army, or the army of Assad the father, you know, was there on the border since 1970. I mean, there with de facto peaceful relations with Israel since 1975, since the separation of forces following the 73 war. And that border, as many of us know, was one of the quietest borders facing Israel for the subsequent decades. So the prospect of a return to that arrangement would not be rejected by Israel. The issue is therefore not Assad. The issue is whether Hezbollah and the Revolutionary Guards Corps and the Iraqi Shia militias are coming along to accompany Assad when he comes back to the border. By the way, let me say that I think most of the people that I speak to, also in Israel, and some of the Brits and Americans and others in the neighbourhood dealing with this stuff, regard it as more or less inevitable that the regime will come back to the border. That's to say that a regime offensive into Dara and Qunetra provinces is just a matter of time and it will come. So the issue is whether, when they come, the Iranians come with them. If there is, if some mechanism or leverage can be found to keep the Iranians back from the border, which is the reason why Netanyahu and Lieberman have been spending so much time in Moscow recently, but one can assume there are also unseen channels to the regime as well, to Assad regime, to tell them, look, if you can come back and not have the Iranians with you, Israel won't have a problem with that. If that can be achieved, then there's every chance, I think, of a de facto accommodation. Now, whether one finds that a cause for rejoicing or wailing and gnashing of teeth is another issue entirely. But, you know, factually speaking, is it achievable? Yes, it's achievable if the Iranians can be kept back from the border.
Can I ask you a question?
A pair of questions on Turkey. When you wrapped up on the emerging strategic blocks, you didn't actually mention where Turkey was sitting in that.
Yeah.
And following from that, if we get a kind of de facto partition of Syria, if there's something that emerges that's Kurdish in the east, how will Turkey respond?
Right. Good. So with regard to the issue of the Turkish position in emerging strategic blocks, it's true, I didn't mention where the Turks are. The Turks are in neither of the strategic blocks, just to be absolutely clear. In other words, Turkey is not, of course, an ally of the or a close ally of the Iranians and their friends. But at the same time, Turkey is not in any way engaged and will not engage in a pro-Western attempt to roll back the Iranians. Turkey is engaged in a quite different project of its own. My view is that, and there's a more superficial analysis which says, no, Turkey's drifting away from its former role as a solid NATO ally, and it's drifting towards the Russians, and perhaps it's drifting even towards other anti-Western forces in the region, maybe even including the Iranians. But I think that's short-sighted, and I'll tell you why. If we look at the pattern of Turkish intervention into Syria, in the two interventions, Operations Euphrates Shield in 2016, and then Olive Branch, wonderfully named, this year, they're not just explicable, in my opinion, in terms of action against the Kurds, even though that's the conventional explanation for them. Because the simple fact of the matter is that, you know, the PYD and its control of parts of the border doesn't actually really threaten the Turks in the short term. The PYD has no intention of launching guerrilla warfare against Turkey from Syria. It may well be aligned with the PKK, but it's a thoroughly Syrian organisation. Which means I think you have to look for additional explanations to understand what the Turks are doing. Specifically, I think what we should begin to consider is the notion that Turkey has noticed that there is a large Sunni Arab population, in fact a majority population there in Syria, and a large Sunni Arab minority in Iraq. And there's a kind of position vacant, so to speak, for somebody to claim to be able to speak in their voice and represent them. And whoever does that will be gaining a considerable amount of power and influence in an important part of the neighbourhood. And I think Turkey wants to propose itself as the country that will sort of speak in the name of what's left of the Syrian opposition. I note the fact that in Afrin Canton and that whole area they've conquered, they've started to entrench themselves, they've created local councils, they're bringing in the Turkish education system, they're hanging Turkish flags on the schools, all fascinating stuff. The Turks look like they want to stay in Sunni northwest Syria. So I think their project is to try to promote themselves in any future political processes. We and our Syrian Sunni Arab rebel allies are the voice of Syrian Sunni Arabs. This, I think, is quite a rational project. From a Turkish interest point of view. I think it's also to some degree an honour or emotional project. The Turks were the first to get behind the rebellion, and it would have been an enormous personal humiliation for Erdogan had the rebellion been utterly obliterated, or should the rebellion be utterly obliterated in northern Syria. I think Turkey is determined to prevent that. With regard to the related question of the Kurdish entity in Syria, look, for as long as the Kurdish de facto entity east of the Euphrates has the protection of United States air power, there's absolutely nothing that the Turks can do about it, unless they want to take on the American Air Force, in which case, again, you know, good luck or whatever, because you're going to need it. Yeah, they don't want to try that. So for as long as America stays in eastern Syria, and it looks like America may be there for a while, because it's no longer only about defeating ISIS for the Americans in eastern Syria, it's also about the broader project of containing Iran, and that area of land means something in that struggle as well. But as long as the Americans are there, there's nothing that the Turks can do. As soon as the Americans aren't there, if in some future context the Americans go, then it may be assumed that the Kurdish entity will be destroyed. It will suffer one of two things. Either it will be destroyed the way that the Afrin Canton was destroyed by the Turkish army after some stiff resistance, but hopeless resistance in the early part of this year, or more likely, in the event that the Americans withdraw, the Kurds, partly in order to avoid, you know, the ruinous prospect of the entry of the Turkish army, will almost certainly cut a deal of some kind or other with the Assad regime for the return of those areas. You know, a very poor deal it'll be too, because they'll be negotiating from a very weak hand at that stage, but they'll negotiate their return to the tender mercies of the Assad regime.
There's a question there.
Hi. We've been interested into Syria, and we constantly see the blown-up images of the destruction of ordinary life in Syria. But half the people are still there. So can you describe for us how those people live? I mean, you just spoke about councils in the Turkish-controlled areas, and ordinary community life, how they eat, how they get their food. There's no one in charge, it seems to us. It's like it's a great big battlefield, but obviously it isn't in many areas. So how does your average Syrian in different areas live day to day? What's it like?
Yes, well, in terms of, it does vary from area of control to area of control, but in terms of life, daily life for people in the Assad-controlled areas, regime-controlled areas, and people in the Kurdish-controlled areas, which together, you know, constitute around 85 to 90% of the entirety of the country. In those areas, daily life, meagre in the extreme as it would seem to us, that is possible and is being maintained. There are centralised authorities, there is policing, there is a degree of security in daily life, there is food provision, there is health provision to a certain degree. The essentials of life are maintained by de facto governing entities of very different kinds. Assad regime, of course, in the regime areas, and then the PYD or PKK created authorities in the Kurdish areas. The places where life has become almost impossible, i.e. where there is no infrastructure and there is no schooling and there is no health provision and there's often precious little food available, are the rebel-controlled areas and the areas controlled by Islamic State. With regard to the Islamic State, it's worth remembering something which has tended to be forgotten, and that is the wretched fate of those civilians who were caught up in the areas controlled by Islamic State when the Western coalition came in to destroy Islamic State. I think most of us here would probably agree that, you know, if ever there was a moral fight, it was the fight to destroy Islamic State. But the fact is, little reported in the media, although reported by NGOs, the fight against Islamic State cost the life of a very large number of civilians. In Raqqa City itself, just Raqqa City, according to Syrian NGOs, 1,873 civilians were killed in the space of 3 months when the coalition was coming in. So life for people caught in the Islamic State-controlled areas, whether they wanted to be there or not, and they didn't invite the Islamic State in, has been wretched and terrible in the extreme. And a similar fate has met, and this is something which I've personally witnessed, life for those people who found themselves in the areas controlled by the rebels in Syria. And that is because the rebels, of course, never had air power, as we noted earlier on, and Assad regime determined, using its air power from the very start, to make sure that nothing resembling a normal administration of life could come into being in the rebel-controlled areas, and it set about destroying any attempt to bring about such a thing from the air, often using the most brutal of means. So that's pretty much the way it's broken down. A meagre and poor life, but life nevertheless, in the regime and Kurdish-controlled areas, and something much less than anything resembling acceptable life in the Islamic State and rebel-controlled areas.
And as a final question, comment, just tell us a bit about Assad. I mean, his background in Britain... Mm-hmm. Where he is now and where he might go?
Certainly. Well, of course, Assad, it's worth remembering, was not the anointed son of Hafez Assad, his father. He wasn't meant to become president of Syria. He was he's the second son of Hafez Assad. And that's the reason why he was sent to London to learn to be an eye doctor. And it was assumed that he would spend his life in relative obscurity as an eye doctor. But that all came to an end when his elder brother, Basel, the anointed son, driving at high speed to Damascus Airport one morning, early morning in the 1990s, drove his car into a wall and managed to get himself killed. And that meant then that Bashar became the anointed one, and in 2000, when Hafez Assad passed away, came back from London with his British-born Syrian Arab wife to become president of Syria. After a short attempt at something resembling reform, laughably misnamed the Damascus Spring at the time. People seem to be keen on that there should be spring in the Middle East, but there really isn't much of a spring at all in the Middle East. People should learn this. Yeah. So after this laughably misnamed episode, Bashar turned back to the authoritarian methods preferred by his father, and he's been ruling, to the best of his abilities, using those very draconian methods ever since, including, of course, in his attempt to destroy the rebellion against him. Where is he now? He's in Damascus, and he's now sufficiently confident in Damascus to begin to film himself again, and to begin to film himself speaking to the people and visiting military units and so on and so forth. Where is he headed? I don't think he's headed anywhere. I think he's staying in Damascus. I don't think there's any serious attempt anymore underway to end his regime by any force, political or military in nature, and therefore I think we can probably look forward, well, that's quite the expression one should use, we can probably expect that Bashar Assad's de facto rule in Damascus and on most of Syrian soil will be continuing for the foreseeable future.
Many thanks. I know there are other questions here, but we're getting close to the top of the hour, and we always finish on time, and I know you've got other commitments tonight. Look, I'll be very brief, because we're all being briefed tonight. I thought that's the best analysis I've heard of the Syrian civil war in my time. Because of your powers of analysis, but also because of your considerable factual and evidentiary knowledge. So we're very grateful for your appearance here at the Sydney Institute tonight. Grateful also to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for bringing you out and making you available to us. Anne will publish your paper in due course. You're on our podcast tomorrow. Sky News Extra is here. But for tonight, congratulations and good luck.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.